So first up, how can we tell what a public space is and what is an accessible private space? Are the lines there blurred?
Yeah, the lines are very blurred. And so we've got quite used to socializing and being sociable in privately owned public spaces. In fact, a lot of scholars would comment that a lot of our sociability has migrated from public spaces into privately owned public spaces, shopping malls, you know, office plazas, all sorts of particular places.
I was going to say the one that jumps to mind for me is the fact that both of 2SER studios here are actually on university campuses, which are a public accessible private space.
No, that's right. So, as I said, the distinction has become quite blurred. There are very traditional accepted public forum public spaces, you know, as you said in your introduction, the national parks, the beaches, foreshores, and even more mundane things like footpaths and cycleways and roads and so on. So we're very used to that being an unqualified public space. But there are many public spaces that have been effectively privatized, and the rules about being on those, you know, quote unquote public spaces are much more restrictive because they're essentially private property, and they're subject to the principles of private property, the rules about exclusion and so forth. So yes.
Yeah, so you mentioned that there's the exclusion and all of the restrictions that come with it being a private space, and that can obviously hinder in some ways the way that we use those spaces. But on the flip side, what advantages can you see in privatizing public spaces?
Well, not a lot, I suppose. I mean, there are some advantages from a planning perspective in that when developers are required to build major developments, large office buildings, and so on, there can be a planning requirement that they make certain areas available for public access. So obviously that's a positive thing, in that there's more open space available for citizens to mix and mingle in. But I see somewhat of a sort of an institutional problem that if we begin to lose sight of the publicness of some of our public spaces, then there's kind of this, you know, tendency of private property to encroach. For centuries, it's been kind of enclosing onto non-private property, and it's kind of a trend we must be very aware of and to resist as much as we can. I mean, obviously, from a planning perspective, there are good reasons to have more spaces rather than just densely built areas, but nonetheless, it's really important to preserve and defend and protect our, you know, truly public spaces.
So because of those concerns with privatization, what would you say is the most important reason we need to protect our public spaces being publicly owned?
Well, there are certain things, you know, there is much more freedom around publicly accessible public spaces than you'd find in privately owned public spaces, simply because in the latter, they're subject to private property's rules at the discretion of the owner, the private owner, whether they decide to ban certain activity or prohibit certain conduct or to sort of arbitrarily exclude people at their whim. And that generally is, you know, the right of a private owner. They have this paramount right to exclude people. And while some places may give the facade or the appearance or the perception of being kind of open, you know, and shopping centres is the classic example of that, it's always at the discretion of the private owner to exclude people. So,
yeah.
You know, it's no accident that in truly public spaces, it's where people gather to protest, to, you know, vent their dissent. You know, it's been described by scholars in America that, you know, public spaces are constitutive of democracy and of democratic tradition. So,
It's very similar to me, it sounds like, debates with social media and free speech, particularly when we look at private platforms in that space.
Yes, I mean, there are certainly analogies. I mean, my interest, I suppose, from a research perspective, is much more into public lands and rights of public, rights of property that go with public lands. Yes, absolutely, there are all sorts of analogies. It's kind of a defense of the public realm or the public domain.
So you mentioned America's use of public spaces, and how does our experience here in Australia with our national parks compare to places overseas, and what things could we learn from each other in terms of using our public spaces and protecting them?
Well, there is, you know, Australia has a great, as you said in your introduction, a great network of openly accessible beaches and you know, national parks. And so compare that to the United States, where many people privatize or effectively privatize the beach by preventing others getting access to the wet sands. So in the US, the wet sands are public property, but the dry sands can be private property. And hence, there's a lot that the US could learn from Australia, I suppose, in terms of greater access to the beaches and the foreshores and so on. So it's an area of law which is kind of not as well ventilated as it should. You know, when people think about property, they think primarily of private property. So we've developed quite a sophisticated jurisprudence around private property, but property and public property are kind of there's a dissonance about it. And we don't have as well as theorized and understood ideas of what public property should entail, what the rights are. And so hence my interest in it. It's an area in which we need to kind of scrutinize and ventilate, think about more.
Well, fantastic. Well, John, unfortunately, that's all the time we have on the show today. If you are interested at all in John's work, we will have links up on the podcast to his research so you can find more about public spaces and what they mean to you. John, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thanks, Felix. Pleasure.